This is September 24th, 2017, and today, as advertised, I'll be talking about the horror show going on in Myanmar and Bangladesh with regard to the Muslim minority Rohingya people, and I guess there are some other one or two other minorities who are also suffering mass persecution. I first picked up on this some years ago, but nothing like it's become this year. I'll be reading from a number of sources. First, just to for people who possibly are not aware of this appalling situation, I'm going to be reading first from an online periodical called The World Post, and this is this one is entitled "The Rohingya Are at the Brink of Mass Genocide," and this is by an Azim Ibrahim. I have written numerous newspaper pieces on the fate of the Rohingya in recent years, and even published a book on this, "The Most Oppressed People in the World," this summer. There's no date on this, but it seems to be quite recent. Oh, yes, there is. Right behind the staple. Wow. Yesterday. This is dated September 23rd. Yet for all they have endured for the past decades, and especially in the last few years, the scariest part of their lives is not that as many as half of them have been displaced from Myanmar, the country of their birth, but many of the rest are now in internally displaced people's camps inside the country in appalling conditions. The scariest part, rather, is what might happen next. With these people so widely reviled by the Buddhist nationalists in their home state of Rakhine and throughout the Union of Myanmar. Myanmar is formerly known as Burma. And with them currently being in such precarious conditions, they are teetering on the edge of outright genocide. He says teetering in an article yesterday, also yesterday, I can't remember where, it's said that a body, an international body, that consists of 66 international members, called Permanent People's Tribunal, a seven-person panel, found the Myanmar government guilty of genocide against the Rohingya people and other Muslim minorities in Myanmar, based on testimony of some 200 victims of the atrocities. So I guess it's kind of a big deal of whether it is officially becomes classified as genocide, but at least here's one international body that has now ruled that it is genocide. They are teetering on the edge of outright genocide. They have been ever since the outbursts of communal violence in 2012 and 2013. So this is not just this year. It's just reached another level, which have caused the largest amount of damage to their communities and triggered the regional Southeast Asian migration crisis, all capitalized, last year. And ever since, we have been dreading what might happen if some random event triggers a new wave of violence from their Rakhine neighbors, or indeed from the police and security agencies of the state. Such a trigger may have just been pulled. 9 police officers were killed and several others injured in attacks on border guard posts near the border with Bangladesh on Sunday, 9th of October. I guess it must, I don't get this. and the Rohingya were collectively declared guilty of the attacks despite there being no evidence that the attackers were, in fact, Rohingya. Never mind which individuals, Rohingya or otherwise, might have been the actual perpetrators. The collective punishment heaped on the Rohingya by state institutions such as the police and army was swift. 24 innocent Rohingya were killed just on Monday, and the numbers seem to be escalating as we speak. What is worse, though these extrajudicial killings have been carried out by local state agencies, the federal forces of the government of Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi are not intervening to stop them and reestablish the rule of law. And if the Rohingya finally give up hope that anyone else might stand up to defend them, they may well end up taking their defense in their own hands. At which point, this can only escalate into an orgy of violence at least as bad as 2012, and perhaps even the outbreak of all-out intercommunal fighting. Not that the Rohingya have the resources to fight such a fight. They will be slaughtered en masse. I guess this article is not, it was published yesterday, because that's the date on it, but it must have been at least last year that this was written. Because it says, the next paragraph is, ever since Aung San Suu Kyi came to power late last year, and it was before last year that she came to power, there has been at least some hope that the country can start making some progress on the situation of the Rohingya. He refers to that before we have another Rwanda on our hands, we have to intervene. Here's another one, still the layout, what the situation is. This also was written last year. This is called Genocide in Burma from the Washington Monthly, and this is written by Joshua Kurlansik. Of all the ethnic, racial, and religious minorities in the world, wrote The Economist last year, the Rohingya, a Muslim ethnic group, may well be the most persecuted people on the planet. They have no in Myanmar, they have no formal status, and they face the constant threat of violence from paramilitary groups, egged on by nationalist Buddhist monks, while security forces look the other way. Since 2012, when the latest wave of anti-Rohingya violence broke out, attackers have burned entire Rohingya neighborhoods, butchering the populace with knives, sticks, and machetes. They beat Rohingya children to death with rifle butts and quite possibly their bare hands. Since then, half the population of Myanmar's Rohingya has been displaced. The most recent count I read was 420,000. Yeah, that's about half. The estimate is 1.1 million, and it's hard with these things that are unfolding day after day to get any kind of accurate figures, but somewhere approaching 500,000. Some have tried to escape to other Southeast Asian nations on rickety boats, often operated by human traffickers. If the migrants do not die of dehydration or heat stroke, they are frequently picked up by pirates or the Thai Navy, which may not be much better than getting nabbed by pirates. Exhaustive reporting by Reuters seems to suggest that Thailand's Navy is closely involved in shuttling Rohingya refugees into slave labor in Thailand's seafood, fishing, and other industries. Rohingya women who do not have enough to pay traffickers are forced into marriages or prostitution. even if the Rohingya make it out of Myanmar, past the pirates, modern-day slavers, and Thai Navy ships, there are few places for them to go. In nearby nations like Malaysia or Indonesia, there is some sympathy for their co-religionists, but they are not willing to give the Rohingya permanent refuge. The Rohingya living in Malaysia operate in the shadows, working in the informal economy, unable to send their children to public schools, with no prospects of resettlement anywhere else. Doesn't sound so different, that particular point, than undocumented immigrants in this country. No prominent nation outside of Southeast Asia is willing to do much for the minority group either. The Rohingya have no close ethnic or linguistic ties with a regional or global power. The Uyghurs, a persecuted Muslim minority in western China, have ethnic and linguistic ties to Turkey. Bangladesh, from which some Rohingya originally migrated, is itself desperately poor and not interested in having the Rohingya settle there. I just also read this past week that Bangladesh government has made the decision to set up a refugee settlement camp just on their side of the border from Myanmar that they hope to be able to accommodate 400,000. And our own government just reduced the number of refugees from the Middle East or Iraq, I'm not sure which, from 110,000 set, the meager 110,000 set by the Obama administration, to 50,000, and they're talking about reducing it even more. Indeed, Bangladeshi security forces have often forcibly repatriated Rohingya or kept them in squalid camps along the Bangladesh-Myanmar border. No Western nations have opened their doors for the Rohingya the way they have, for instance, for the Tibetans who make it out of China. For those Rohingya living in Myanmar, the future is horrifically grim. They are packed into camps that are little more than internment centers, with residents given minimal food and shelter, and so forth and so forth. A little history, because I think it helps to understand how this could happen in a nominally Buddhist country. Many Rohingya have lived in Myanmar for generations, having migrated there during the British Raj. In his new book, The Rohingyas, Inside Myanmar's Hidden Genocide, one of the few accessible primers on this battered group, the Oxford and U.S. Army's Strategic Studies Institute, fellow Azim Ibrahim, that's the guy whose short article we just read from, tells of how the Rohingya have never had an easy time in Myanmar. Beginning in 1962, when a junta seized power, up until the transition to civilian rule in the early 2010s, that's when Aung San Suu Kyi was released from house arrest, the Burmese government effectively stripped most Rohingya of their rights. In 1982, the military government removed the Rohingya from the list of 135 officially recognized ethnic groups in Myanmar. The Buddhist Rakhine people generally held a deep distrust of the Rohingya as interlopers, a distrust heightened during World War II when many Rohingya fought with the British and many Rakhine fought alongside Japan. Rakhine nationalists had always chafed at the junta's rule. And then it says in parentheses, the Rakhines once had their own powerful kingdom, separate from the ethnic Burmans. But in 1978, according to Human Rights Watch, many Rakhines made common cause with the Myanmar army. They forced roughly 200,000 Rohingya to flee, mostly into camps in Bangladesh. Again, in 1991, units of the Myanmar army attacked the Rohingya, driving some 250,000 out of their homes, with many fleeing into Bangladesh once more. Then in the early 2010s, the junta gave way to civilian rule for myriad reasons. From the beginning of the transition, it was clear that if the army loosened its grip, violent nationalist groups would step into the political vacuum. Myanmar's primary democratic party would do little to stop these forces. From interviewing many members of this party, I found that the party and its leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, were primarily concerned with building up their own power, reducing the role of the military, and winning over Buddhist voters in the first free national elections in 25 years. In the weeks before last November's election, Suu Kyi herself told reporters not to, quote, over-exaggerate the threat facing the Rohingya, and other prominent longtime Democrats openly inveighed against the Rohingya using racist taunts. When the highly anticipated national elections were finally held, there were no Rohingya, indeed no Muslim candidates from any ethnic group on the dominant party slate. And there's more history, but we don't have time for more history. One of the most distressing features of this horror is this Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi basically turning her head and looking the other way while this is happening. We'll get more into that just a little bit later. Earlier this month, she stated that the Myanmar government, quote, had already started defending all the people in Rakhine in the best way possible and expressed that there be no misinformation to create trouble between the two countries. This response was criticized by Desmond Tutu, a fellow Nobel Peace Prize laureate. Of course, the Myanmar government blames terrorists for initiating the violence. It's always a good one these days just to label people terrorists. And speaking of labels, probably I don't have to spend much time making the point that just because someone self-identifies as a certain religion doesn't mean that they embody the spirit of that religion. This is so humbling to see this play out now, because until now there's been little that can be pointed to in history that to show that there's ever been a war waged in the name of Buddhism. There was a civil war in Sri Lanka, and one of the parties, one of the two groups, was often labeled Buddhist. So that was bad enough, but this is just hard to even imagine. Just a little personal story. I went to Burma. It was then called Burma. In 1979, I was with three others here on staff. We did a short pilgrimage, 6 weeks. We were only allowed to go to Burma for 1 week. That was the maximum you could get a visa for. And I have to say, I was bowled over by how gentle and warm and kind everyone was who we met there. They say that Burma is, or Myanmar now, is 99% Buddhist. And in a Zenbo article in 1979 or 80, I wrote about the joy of being in a country where you're not at half a percent, as a Buddhist, not half a percent of the population, but part of the 99%. And I saw no signs there of what obviously is the dark underside of all that. We know from other religious conflicts in this century and previous centuries that all kinds of devilish things can be done in the name of religion by people who have completely forsaken the real teaching of that religion. I remember before I came to the Zen Center, I was pretty proud in my criticism of Christianity. I used to tell people that when I think of Christianity, I think of the Crusades, the Inquisition, and the Hundred Years' War. But now, I have to kind of eat those words, because people now could be saying, when I think of Buddhism, I think of the slaughter, the genocide against the Muslim minority people in Myanmar. It's not fair to make these judgments. It's all too easy to just accept a label, and then it becomes more of an ethnic identification. It's a nationalistic identification, not religious. Yesterday I received an email from one of our local members who had her own experience in Myanmar. She said, I visited Myanmar in 2003 for a day trip in order to renew my Thai visa against the recommendations of every Thai person I knew. So this is 14 years ago. I walked over a bridge into the village of Miawadi, a village of mostly ethnic Burmese. I had to surrender my visa at the border and was required to have an escort to show me around the village. He was a very friendly tour guide. Once he realized I could speak Thai, he started telling me the litany of human rights violations the military perpetrated against the villagers there. According to him, rape, murder, political imprisonment of entire families, these were all commonplace occurrences perpetrated by the soldiers and the military. Elsewhere in my reading for this morning's Taisho, I saw that young men are drafted in the military under the threat of imprisonment. Learning English was forbidden in order to limit knowledge of outside news. Well, here it is. Men became soldiers mostly because they had no choice, and if they refused, they could be imprisoned or killed. He told me these things at his own risk because his job was really to portray a pretty picture of Myanmar to tourists, and he could be arrested for telling me these things. He asked me why the U.S. didn't step in to save them, quote, like they did for Iraq, and he asked me to try and help his country when I went back home. And then she says, it was really a heartbreaking and eye-opening experience, really one of the most powerful experiences of my life. I felt a tangible presence of this oppression and violence, although I didn't witness anything other than the soldiers on patrol, some propaganda billboards, and the efforts to tightly control tourism. So you mix in this forced service in the military with what we know is our common lot, which is a deep wiring toward tribalism, or what we're now more often calling otherism. This is frightening how deeply we are conditioned to see those of other ethnic groups or racial groups as other, and in doing so, then to mistreat them one way or another. We see it happening on a much less dramatic scale here in our own country. A little bit more from this woman's account. The Burmese people take great pride in their religion, that is Buddhism, and I could see anti-Muslim sentiment being something they could easily rally about. They've been fed racist government propaganda for decades, and the ethnic minorities have been traditional targets. This is a country where for most of recent history, people have lived under constant fear. So, not that this justifies what's happening, but it helps us understand some of what goes into this terrible persecution. Of just when your only source of information, or almost only source of information, is this constant propaganda that tells you that people of this minority religion are less than human. Yeah, how can any of us understand that when that's our only input is government propaganda, hateful government propaganda, for decades? Another person wrote me yesterday an email after seeing the Sangha message announcement that I was going to be talking about this. This is also someone who, this is actually Meecher Roshi, Meecher Bishop Roshi, who has a center in New Mexico and in California. She lived in Burma at the time. She was married to someone in the State Department who was there. And she mentions one of her students' daughter, who was a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And this reporter actually met with Rohingya folks. This was 4 years ago. And also with the chief perpetrator of the conflagration, a Buddhist monk, above whose temple altar are featured multiple very large portraits of, wait for it, himself. And then she made a second point. Having lived in Myanmar for several years, although it was decades ago, it was patently clear to me that most of the Buddhist monks, quote unquote, in Myanmar were in the monasteries as an easy way of life and had nothing to do with any spiritual aspirations. Among other things, while I was living in Mandalay, it's one of the three principal cities, it's one of the three cities my fellow pilgrims and I went to when we were in Burma, there were several days of riots by Buddhist monks fighting between two different Buddhist sects. What initiated the riots was one sect placing an ad in a local newspaper accusing the other sect of being yellow cows. I'm waiting for the laughter. That this would trigger violence, that someone insulted you in a stupid way like that. It's just further evidence of what a deplorable state of religious life, such as it is, there is in Burma. And all of this suddenly occurred to me this morning while I was sitting here in the Zendo. I remembered a long article that I read a long time ago. There's no date on this. It's an article called The Broken Buddha, and the subtitle is Critical Reflections on Theravada and a Plea for a New Buddhism. And this is by an S. Dhammika, who became ordained in Thailand, I think, one of those Southeast Asian countries. And this is a 40-something page, single-space tract criticism of what Buddhism has become in, yes, Burma and Thailand, primarily those two. I just had enough time to pluck out a few passages here that I think is important to understand in terms of the so-called Buddhist persecution of, especially the Buddhist monks. He writes, at the time of the Buddha, people became monks or nuns for the overcoming of suffering, for the attaining of nirvana. As strange as it may seem, this is probably the least common reason for entering the Theravadin Sangha. Theravadin is just the counterpart to the Mahayana. Buddhism has two broad streams. There are those in the Mahayana tradition, such as Zen, and then the Theravadan tradition, which literally means the teaching of the elders. It's more of an early Buddhist teachings. The Theravadan is primarily Southeast Asia. That is Burma, Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia, and Vietnam. In Burma and Thailand, he writes, all males are expected to ordain at least once in their life. This experience could have a positive influence on a person, but in most cases it seems to leave little impression. I once stayed in a large and well-run monastery in Mandalay, that's that same city in Burma, Myanmar. Being the only Westerner there, I was often surrounded by smiling, friendly monks curious to see me and to practice their English on me. In a nearby room stayed a much older monk, and I noticed that every time he came to join the little group around me, the others became quiet, appeared to be a little nervous, and one by one drifted off, leaving just the two of us together. This older monk spoke excellent English, and it appeared from my conversations with him that he had a good grasp of Dharma and an interest in meditation. At first I thought the discomfort of the others in his presence was just deference to his age, or perhaps his position in the hierarchy. Later I found out that the real reason, he was chief of the local dreaded secret police and had a well-earned reputation for brutality. Once a year he would spend a few weeks as a monk, quote, practicing Buddhism. In Burma, all males become monks for a while because, well, simply because it is the tradition. In both countries, that is Burma and Thailand, the majority disrobe after a few days, weeks, or months, but others decide to stay. They do this for a variety of reasons. Some develop a genuine interest in the Dharma. Some find the sedate life of the monastery a welcome escape from work and social obligations. Some don't have what it takes to make it in the world and have no choice but to stay. This means that a given percentage, usually quite a high percentage, of monks have little or no real interest in the spiritual life. That's Exhibit A. And then here's more. According to the Vinaya, that's the compendium of monastic rules and regulations that dates back to the Buddha, according to the Vinaya, a boy as young as 8 can become a novice monk. Burmese temples. Oh, in India, all sorts of disreputable types turn up at the few Thai and Buddhist and Burmese temples in the country and are given ordination as long as they go somewhere else afterwards. They amble off without training, knowing nothing about the Dharma, using their robes to make a living, and usually giving Buddhism a bad reputation in the process. In 1975, the exiled former military dictator of Thailand, Thanom Kittikorn, became a monk in Singapore and slipped back into his country. Being a monk gave him immunity from the many criminal charges against him. He plotted his return to power, disrobed, and then staged a coup. In the early 1990s, a Thai monk raped and murdered a British tourist and then threw her body in a cave. After his arrest, it was discovered that he was a heroin addict with a long criminal record and had just got out of jail a few weeks previously. Despite this, he had no difficulty getting ordained. Another one, a guy he met, a monk he met, had ordained, he said, to get enough money to start up another nightclub. It's pretty lucrative being a monk in Burma and Thailand. It is, because the idea is that the more money you give the monks, the more merit you acquire. Then, skipping another page, as with so much else in Theravadan Buddhism, emphasis is on getting the procedure right, not the purpose behind the procedure. As with the locals, a Westerner can turn up at a Theravadin monastery in Asia and be ordained almost immediately. In keeping with the Vinaya, he will be asked whether he is a human, whether he is a male, etc. But he won't be asked what most intelligent people would consider more pertinent questions, like, do you have a criminal record? Have you suffered from mental illness? Can you read and write? Is this really what you want to do? Astonishingly, he won't even be asked if he is a Buddhist. Where else in the world would it be possible to become a clergyman in a religion before knowing anything about that religion? Now, here is something I think extremely important, is what this guy who spent years and years in Southeast Asia, what he learned about the absence of meditation. Because we know anyone who's meditated for very long could never imagine doing these things that we hear about toward the Rohingya, because it's in meditation that we come to confirm our indivisibility with all beings, where we feel more and more intimate with others, including others of other religions. And he says, another thing that makes Tibetan Buddhism more attractive to Westerners than Theravada is that it has a richer contemplative tradition. Well, that, of course, would be true of Zen, too. And more of its monks are experienced in meditation. And by the way, when I was in Tibet, I didn't see any meditation. Compared to the Zen tradition, meditation is just one of a whole host of practices, and not one that you necessarily do as a monk. The majority of Theravadin monks know little or nothing of meditation. The idea of hundreds of monasteries filled with thousands of monks diligently meditating every day is one of the many illusions Westerners have about Theravada in Asia. As far as Sri Lanka is concerned, it might even be true to say that there is a distinct anti-meditation culture within much of the Sangha. Few monks meditate, so one who does is immediately out of step with the majority. His practice will be a continual reminder to the others that they are not doing what they are supposed to, and naturally they resent this. I'm guessing that this American or British author of this piece, former monk himself, is speaking from experience. The meditator will become the target of subtle jibes and snide comments. If he accidentally leaves his toothbrush in the bathroom, someone is sure to say with a self-satisfied smile, "Ah, not very mindful today, are we?" I know I've heard from people who say they get that from their spouse. They will rarely miss the opportunity to put him down or disparage him. To make matters worse, the meditating monk will soon attract the attention of the laity, and they will come to the monastery asking to see him, telling the others how much they admire him, and bringing gifts for him. It won't be long before the other monks' jealousy is aroused, and they will start making the meditator's life quite uncomfortable. So, I hope then this can put to rest any illusions any of you who are listening to this have about at least the Buddhist monks' role in this. I mean, yes, there may be plenty they're doing, but it is hardly a reflection of the true spirit of monastic accomplishments. And then as far as the people as a whole, I guess it sounds like there are the number of monks who are doing this slaughter is a lot fewer monks doing it than lay people. Well, there it is. It's the same old story from time immemorial, is us against them. Let me just close by expressing my own sense of obligation of contributing, donating to the cause of the Rohingya. Who cares whether they're Muslim or Zoroastrian? What they're going through at the hands of nominally Buddhist people makes me feel all the more obliged to donate there, rather than the many other desperately needy people in this world who need it. Others can just decide for themselves. There's no end to the need for money. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless fine passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the liberating way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to meditate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to meditate the great way of Buddha. I'm